How fun was that? My mom called this afternoon and asked me what I did today. Not much. Just taught Sunday school, led worship, sang in the choir, baptized, ran by the hospital. It's okay, Mom, I can nap later. It's all right. It's okay. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Starting with verse 1. You know it. You can recite it. Some of you know it because it's scripture and you've heard it a lot. Some of you know it because of the song. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Starting with verse 1. Let's hear these sacred words. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Time to kill and a time to heal. Time to break down and a time to build up. Time to weep and a time to laugh. Time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together. Time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. There's a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain have the workers from their toil? I have seen the busyness that God has given to everyone to be busy with. He has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds, yet they cannot find what God has done from the beginning to the end. This is the word of the Lord. There was a medical doctor who was talking with a friend one day. And the doctor said, there is a disease which no knife or drugs can touch, it seems. The person responded, you mean cancer? Oh no, that's not it, the doctor said. We're going to get that devil or devils one day. No, I mean boredom, the doctor said. It's amazing to see how many people suffer from boredom in life. We hear younger people especially say all the time, oh, I'm so bored. This is boring. This is terrible. But this isn't a problem confined just to young people, is it? Sooner or later, all of us discover that much of life is monotonous, it is routine, and much of life is daily. There are tasks that have to be repeated again and again. There are young men and young women who dream of what they're going to do, and then they head off to college or seminary to pursue their goals. The pursuit of knowledge seems an exciting adventure with a dream ahead at a distance. But then they go to school and realize that their education itself entails sitting in a class and listening to lectures, and week after week, they read book after book and write paper after paper and take test after test, and pursuit of knowledge and the training and the credentials to do their dream gets so routine, so monotonous, so boring. There are people who dream of becoming doctors, lawyers, nurses, bankers, dentists, teachers, accountants, other professions who start their work after they finish school, and they soon realize that there are tasks and routines that have to be done day after day to accomplish their jobs. For many, no matter how exciting their career may have once seemed, soon it becomes monotonous and daily if we're not careful. Others dream of being ministers. They have a genuine gift of sharing the word of God or the love of God with people in what they do. They want to see lives transformed through what they do, or at least change for the better because of Christ's love and teachings. But some become disillusioned. One minister said, that's it, I quit. I've had it with the church. For 20 years I've worked and nobody wants anything that matters. They drain you dry and they are never satisfied, and all they ever do is take and gripe about the littlest things, and if they can't get their way, they walk away. I quit, he said. When Bo Prosser and I were writing our book on marriage several years ago now, we decided to do something all too unusual for Christian resources on marriage. We included a section on affairs and, you guessed it, boredom. To oversimplify, these two are almost always related, affairs and boredom. A young wife told me once, "I'm on my second marriage and I give up on the fairy tale life. This is too routine, too boring. It is never going to be mine." And among the statistical clusters of divorce, the 7-year mark is the hardest one to explain. The closest anyone can come is to speculate that this is just about long enough for boredom to begin to set in. Boredom may be the root cause for many problems in our society. Out of a deep sense of boredom, some people turn to alcohol or drugs in search of excitement, or at the very least in search of self-medicating. A lot of the vandalism, theft that happens everywhere, it may be a sign to us that there are bored people in our midst, especially kids, but not just kids. I see a lot of people manufacture their own career crises because they can't deal with what seems to be the monotony of their lives. There are some wars that, if we were being honest and really dug to try to understand what had happened, probably have boredom among their true causes. One cartoon showed a snail sitting on top of a large ball. The inscription reads, "Slowly but surely, I'm getting nowhere." Well, now that I have you wanting a good word from Ecclesiastes, the writer here seems familiar with the problem of boredom. From his view, life seems hard. All is vanity and vexation of the spirit, he says early on in Ecclesiastes. So does even he have anything to offer us today? Or does he simply join us in admitting that sometimes life can get a little too routine? You may have seen a while back a Hagar the Horrible comic strip. It showed Hagar's wife standing over him while he sat with his familiar mug in hand. She is holding a bucket in one hand and a mop in the other. This cartoon is dated. It's a few years ago and not politically correct for today. But she's standing there with a bucket and a mop, and he is sitting there, and she says, "Remember how you said I'd have a life of luxury as soon as your ship comes in?" And he says, "Yes," from his chair, with his feet propped up, and she says, "It sank, didn't it?" The odd book of Ecclesiastes sits within a small collection of books in our Bible that we describe as Old Testament wisdom literature. You might remember some of the others in that wisdom collection. Proverbs is considered to be wisdom literature. Song of Solomon is in the wisdom section, along with Job. And some people even find some wisdom inclusions within the Psalms. Koheleth, the stated writer of Ecclesiastes, has experienced life from the perspective of one who has great means. That becomes evident as you read the totality of Ecclesiastes. Some believe him even to have been King Solomon. Whoever the writer of Ecclesiastes is, he has tried everything and bought everything and has achieved everything that should bring fulfillment and excitement, and instead, he has observed the human limitations that make him feel that life is a rather trapped state of being. For our benefit, the writer calls us back to assess life in summary. That's what you heard just a few minutes ago. He lists in this poem 14 lines that yield at least, by some counts, 7 sets of life tasks. Thesis and antithesis, give and take, time to be born and time to die, time to plant, time to pluck up what is planted, time to kill, time to heal, time to break down, time to build up, time to weep, time to laugh, time to mourn, and time to dance. You heard these just a few minutes ago. And in these lines, it's found a lot of perspective. At least a lot that could give us perspective. For one thing, you hear a sense of variety in this list that the writer assembled in Ecclesiastes, trying to summarize all that we do in a lifetime. Life really isn't all that much the same if we look at his list and consider it. If you take the events and the lessons in there individually, all of these events are lived out under the watchful eye of a loving God. Our God is not indifferent to our victories, our faithfulness, nor to our sufferings. You should also hear a sense of balance in this list. Go back and look at it. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to sow and a time to tear apart. There's balance in these words, if we're being fair to them. One time after a playoff softball game on a team which I was playing, there was one inning where I leapt high and stabbed a line drive out of the air. It was a wonderful play. And then the next inning, I blew an easy grounder that should have been a can of corn. And the spouse of one of the people I was playing with said to me after the game, he says, "Yeah, sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug." There's a sense of balance to what the writer of Ecclesiastes has experienced and is reminding us of in this summary. There's also acknowledgement of perspective in these verses. Life never leaves us the same. If we choose to, we can either move forward, worse for the wear, or we can learn the lessons and gain strength from the bad, even. Old and New Testament literature alike suggest that the truly wise accept life under God for what it is. Some of it shines, some of it is truly dark. Think about your life. You sleep at night, hopefully. The next morning you get up, you fix a meal, then you eat it. You brush your teeth, and you go off to work or whatever you're going to spend your day doing. At home or someplace else. And if you've been off to work or to some activity or some participation, you return home later and maybe you rest or you play or you do chores. Then you go to bed and you sleep and the cycle begins again the next day. There is routineness to life. But suppose a lot of the people in your life refuse to do those daily tasks, those repetitive tasks in their own lives. Suppose my mom refused to show up at the bank for her work as a teller back before she retired. Or if your courier refused to deliver the packages that you were looking for, didn't drive the truck one day. What if the people who stocked the groceries in the store decided to not stock any more food? Or the farmers decided they were tired of raising crops and there was nothing in the fields? What if our electric, gas, or oil companies, our carpenters, doctors, teachers, or administrative assistants decided not to show up for their daily work? Many sometimes question the importance of their labors in light of what may be happening in the world around them. But it's interesting to notice the men and women who have made the greatest contributions and discoveries were those who worked faithfully at their task day after day. Thomas Edison didn't sit down one day and say, "I'm going to discover something that will change the world today." His discoveries were the result of his working routinely day after day in his laboratory. He showed up day after day, and he worked and practiced and failed more times than he succeeded. Books are very much in the news again these days because of some enormously popular bestsellers, but each of these authors could probably tell you that they keep stashed away stacks of rejection letters that they received way back in their careers from publishers at some early stage who didn't know them and didn't want to look at their work or had no use for it. I still have over 60 rejection letters that Bo and I got trying to get our first book published. A reminder of a painful time of investment and hope that was not rewarded immediately. The writer of Ecclesiastes does not write this section with the hope of inspiring us to make the most of the day. This is no carpe diem, seize the moment sort of message intended to inspire us to get more productive. Not in chapter 3. This is a case of him trying to build toward an understanding of human limitation. And then he turns this towards some helpful perspectives that I hope you'll take home today. In the 1960s, a popular recording group released a song that I referenced just a few minutes ago, and that I dare guess all of you have heard. The song was a huge hit then, and it keeps popping up in movies and television soundtracks. Forrest Gump was one of the biggest users, most prominent users of this song in that popular movie years ago. The song is called Turn, Turn, Turn. And Pete Seeger has admitted that he was inspired to write that song after hearing this text that you heard a few minutes ago from Ecclesiastes 3 read in a public service. Maybe these lyrics will remind you to everything. Turn, turn, turn. There is a season. Turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. These are the words of Koheleth, the teacher, the one who writes down this wisdom book of Ecclesiastes. And as memorable as the poetic stretches of chapter 3 are, our takeaways for today might be found only after we get past those and look down into the few verses that were left in our text earlier. Actually, most would see the commentary running on through verse 15 if you want to read just now. But today, let's see if we can benefit from the verses you heard, stopping with verse 11. First, the question of verse 9 is the question that most of us find ourselves asking ourselves again and again. What gain has the worker from his toil? Even for those of us who love what we do and for whom going to work does not always feel like going to work, such that it's what we do time after time again, and relatively happily so, we might would say, but it can still feel like the whole of our lives can get a little too daily. Like the snail said earlier, where am I getting? What is the worth of it all? And that's what the writer asked as he finished summarizing what life can bring us. And we might do well to admit that even the wealthiest and most powerful of us operate within these limitations. It's just that we experience those limitations differently. Some have great wealth and achievement only to experience the broken heart of health problems, a broken family, or dreams that are never fulfilled, tragedy that might strike. We all eventually learn that we can't work hard enough or long enough to answer some of the brokenness that comes our way in life. Sometimes we just realize that we are only beginning to figure out a lot of what life wants us to figure out and what God would have us to know when we run out of time and look back to wonder what good we did with our lives. Given these limitations of what we can control and what we cannot control, the beginning of humans living within God's wisdom might be as we accept the limitations for what they are and then begin to awaken to the insights, such as the writer did here. And then we get on with living in these seasons for what God has created them to be and for what God has created us to be, and begin, if we're watching, to find tremendous freedom and choice within how we respond to this dailiness. The creativity of life, maybe in how we adjust and adapt to what we could see as the sameness of life. Biblical wisdom literature suggests that the test of our own wisdom or folly might be our adjustments to the realities of life. Secondly, The writer of Ecclesiastes has made a discovery that we ought to pay attention to. In addition to the question of what comes from all of our toil, Koheleth has something good that has come from all of his adventure that seemingly led to nowhere in achieving, buying, collecting, and playing, really posturing for what should have been a successful life. He found that in the midst of the busyness of it all, the distraction of it all, God really does have constructive business for us to do. This is not a theory or a hope he speaks of. Somewhere in all the busyness the writer has created in the midst of his hustle to be important and fulfilled, the reality of God's hopes for humanity has quietly slipped in the door past him. Accidentally, he seems to have experienced the good that God plans for us. There is a difference, he discovers, that we can make in each other's lives, and perhaps all too late, this teacher has realized it. God has not just set us loose within chaos. It's not all about you or me or the writer of Ecclesiastes. It's not all about me. That's what he has tried and found no fulfillment at all in. You and I get bombarded with the same message today, and we find this to be equally empty and unfulfilling eventually in our lives. It's all about me. And he's discovered that it's not. Finally, the writer gives us this perspective. That is, God has made life to work in the fullness of time, which admittedly is not always our time. The trouble is, he acknowledges that we'll have to live this life without actually getting to see God's blueprint. The writer in Ecclesiastes 3 says it this way: God has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds, yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning and will do to the end. I've noticed something about our kind, church people. It drives church people wild to think that we might know something about someone's illness or something about a program or a ministry that it's not time for everyone to know just yet. We humans don't like to know that there's a plan or some information out there that we don't have and that we can't get our hands on. We think we have to know everything. It seems to be the way we're wired. Yet here is God's creation still unfolding, and we don't get to read the specs. We have all these questions about how it started, and we have filled the bookshelves with writings about how we think it will end. And the voice in Ecclesiastes tells us that the beginning of wisdom is in getting on with our lives as God would have us to live, even though we don't get to know what's on the other side of our own era. We are to pass through and keep moving. We are parts of a whole that is larger than us, larger than our time. And the wise among us become okay with that, trusting in God to bring order to it all. So with this sense of eternity that God has put into us, we turn from what we can't control, can't know, and move on, with the goal of pleasing the very God who has blessed and cursed us with all this mystery. Life really can get so daily. The good news is that we have a God who is more than daily. That God is eternal. Now, can our faith catch up so that we are able to find peace in life? Will we stop wondering about the consumer questions of faith long enough to participate in what God has designed for us? A group of students some years ago at Johns Hopkins University up in Baltimore, and these students were in a sociology class, and they had a project that was assigned to them, and I have one of those degrees. I have lived this. You hunt for a project that you can actually do within an academic semester and try to make a decent grade at. And so these sociology students were hunting through files of past projects, trying to get ideas for themselves. And they stumbled upon a survey that had been done 20 years before. It was a survey of residents in a particular neighborhood in Baltimore where they were, and it was surveying particularly a group of children. And they started to read through the survey and the write-up that came after it, the results of that, and the results predicted that these children lived in such a poor and unstable neighborhood, a neighborhood racked with crime and things that are just unhealthy to live within. And so the conclusion was that these children were destined for a life of trouble. Most of these, if not all of them, were destined to at some point or another spend time in jail, and some of them might not live very long. That was the conclusion that the survey predicted. And so this group of sociology students, 20 years later, decided, let's go see if we can find those children. Let's go see, 20 years later, if they're still in the neighborhood, and if they are, what they're doing, and if they're not, who might know them, and might be able to tell us what they're doing today. And so they began to follow up. They went out into the neighborhood, and they began to interview people. And what they discovered surprised them. In fact, they couldn't have been any more surprised, because not a single one of the youth that had participated in that neighborhood study had become criminals, though they had lived and grown up in the worst poverty conditions. Why? There was a common thread, they found, and this became the crux of their study. There was a common thread. It was a woman that everyone called Aunt Hannah. She actually wasn't related to any of them, but she was in all their lives. She saw most of these children every day, and the others she saw several times a week. She saw to it that they got their homework done and provided a place for them to do it if they wanted that. She loved them and did things for them. She taught them things, and she challenged them to become the kinds of people that they should become. Aunt Hannah filled in a lot of the gaps that otherwise would have gone on unchecked in the lives of these young students. One woman had taken an interest in them. And some of these young men and women out of that neighborhood, the toughest neighborhood in Baltimore, had become teachers, professionals, doctors, lawyers, dentists. One woman taking an interest in them and what they did in school and what they did with their lives and with their free time, and she had influenced their lives for unchangeable good. Life can get so daily. The trick is whether we can notice the voice of God speaking into our routine and do the things and be the things that God would have us to be and to do. Because we don't get to see what's on either side of us, and we don't know how God may be using us even now. Our hymn of response is printed in our worship bulletin. It's hymn number 509. Trust and obey. I can't think of a better way for us to debrief what we have just considered, words that you've just heard. And so if you have a decision that you need to make, Steve is going to be waiting here at the front. I'm going to take off and go get ready for baptism, and I invite those who need to get ready also to take off to the chapel. And we'll be waiting for you over there if you choose to come by and be a part of witnessing that beautiful act after our worship service here. Otherwise, you may choose to stand where you are, but sing together with you this familiar hymn, Trust and Obey.